Morning, everyone. Again, let's start with a short meditation before we go into our discussions for today. So, finding a nice, comfortable posture. As an act of loving kindness for yourself, allow your awareness to descend into the body, becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And bringing your awareness to the area of your face, softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. All the muscles around the eyes, soft and relaxed. In this way, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. And allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now narrow your focus and focus on the sensations of the breath at the entrance of the nostrils. Now, do you have a sense that there is a me here who is trying to relax the body, and a me who is trying to focus the mind on the breath? A me that seems to exist from its own side, not seeming to depend upon anything else to exist. Do you have this experience? Where is this me who is trying to relax the body and focus the mind? Where is the me who is trying to become the master of the body and the mind? Where is the me who is trying to relax the body? Is the body simply trying to relax itself? Or is there a me separate from the body who is trying to relax the body? If there seems to be a me who is trying to relax the body, where is this me? So search thoroughly and see if you can find the me who is trying to relax the body. And where is the me who is trying to focus the mind on the breath? Is the mind simply trying to focus itself? Or is there a me separate from the mind who is trying to focus the mind? If there seems to be a me separate from the mind who's trying to focus the mind, where is this me? So again, search thoroughly and see if you can find the me who is trying to focus the mind on the breath. Now, in your direct experience, what is actually here? There is the constant flow of physical change that is called the body. And there is the constant flow of mental experience that is called the mind. Yet, other than the body and the mind, what else is there here? If there's nothing more than the body and the mind here, then where is the me who is trying to relax the body and focus the mind? However, it's undeniable that there's someone who's experiencing all of this. So there is a me. But how can this me exist if we don't seem to be able to find it? The me exists as something merely labeled on the body and the mind. Nothing more than this. Not existing from its own side. The merely labeled me is relaxing the body and focusing the mind. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest, simply resting in awareness itself, not doing anything at all, simply being present, simply being aware of being aware. Resting in the stillness of awareness. Again, let's start with a short review before we move on to today's topic. So again, we've been using the Four Noble Truths as the basis of all of our discussions. And so remember, in the Four Noble Truths, we saw that it's equivalent to the analogy of physical illness, that the Buddha is like our doctor, that the first two noble truths is the Buddha's diagnosis for us. The first part of the diagnosis, of course, is that we are stuck in this state of unsatisfactory state of dukkha. That's the human condition. And why are we stuck in this state? Is the second noble truth, the underlying cause, and that is, of course, the mental afflictions. And in particular, the root mental affliction is ignorance, our misunderstanding of the nature of reality, The Buddha's prognosis, of course, is very good. He said that we can overcome this unsatisfactory state of dukkha. We can achieve a healthy state, a state of liberation from all suffering and its causes. The third noble truth, truth of cessation, the ending of all suffering and its causes. That healthy state, of course, is called nirvana. Then what's the Buddha's cure or medicine? Is the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And there we saw it's usually presented as the noble eightfold path, eight particular practices to engage in. And we saw that those eight practices can be condensed into three core areas of practice. Ethics is the foundation. On that basis, concentration. Shamatha practice, developing a calm, clear, focused mind. And then on the basis of concentration, on the basis of a calm, clear, focused mind, we engage in the wisdom practice or the Vipassana practice, coming to gain an insight into reality so that we can overcome ignorance, mental afflictions and suffering. And so today we are going to look at this wisdom practice, the Vipassana practice. And just to give a piece of advice I gave right at the beginning of this course, and that was to not have the expectation that we will understand everything we hear. Particularly today, this topic of the nature of reality is very profound, not very easy to understand. So if we have the expectation that by the end of today we'll have a reasonably good idea of the Buddhist view of reality, I think we're just setting ourselves up for a lot of frustration. Because probably what's going to happen is now we probably don't understand the nature of reality. Then I'll say something and then at some point you'll go, okay, I think I understand the Buddhist view of reality now. And then I'll keep talking and then a little bit later you'll go, I don't understand anything at all. I'm completely confused. And then I'll keep talking and then you go, oh, now I really understand. And then I'll keep talking and go, no, I'm completely confused. This is probably what's going to happen. This is a good sign. It means you're thinking about what I'm saying and not just sort of accepting, yes, 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 that's true, because then we're not really understanding. So whatever you can pick up today, be happy with that. What you don't understand, which may be many things, next time you listen, read, reflect, you'll understand a little bit more. So definitely this topic of nature of reality is something that we'll need to listen to, think about, meditate many, 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 many times before we start to appreciate what it really means. So if we have that attitude, we will avoid a lot of unnecessary frustration today. Okay. So in the Four Noble Truths, of course, the Four Noble Truths is the foundation of all Buddhist traditions. And in particular, the Four Noble Truths is really the core of the Theravada traditions in Buddhism. So in the Theravada traditions, they really have as their core the Four Noble Truths, meaning the goal of the spiritual path in the Theravada is nirvana, this liberation from suffering. And, of course, how to achieve that? Generally, in the Theravada traditions, you will see this presentation of the Eightfold Path, the Noble Eightfold Path. And then often that is condensed into these three core areas of practice, ethics, concentration, wisdom. And again, any of you who've done a Goenka Vipassana retreat know this very well, part of the Theravada tradition. Goenkaji is talking a lot about these three higher trainings, Sila, Samadhi, Panya, Sila, Samadhi, Panya, ethics, concentration, wisdom, the three core areas of practice. So ethics we've already looked at briefly, particularly in terms of these 10 virtues as a basis for ethical lifestyle. The concentration practice, shamatha practice, I've mentioned a little bit about that in the beginning of this course, but I want to talk more in detail about that tomorrow afternoon. And so then the wisdom practice, Vipassana practice, is the topic for today. So, of course, the Theravada tradition is following the Pali, through the Pali language. So, of course, the word for the wisdom practice here is Vipassana. And, of course, the Sanskrit word is Vipassana. In both of these words, Vi means higher or superior. Passana or Passana means to see. So Vipassana is higher seeing, seeing beyond. Often translated into English as insight or special insight. And of course here we're talking about insight into the nature of reality. So generally in the Theravada traditions, when they talk about Vipassana practice, as we saw yesterday, we're talking primarily about gaining three insights called the three marks of existence. The first of the insights we are trying to gain in Vipassana practice is an insight into impermanence, the fact that things are changing moment by moment. So again, I think all of us, at least intellectually, understand this already. We learned it at school, science has proven it, the fact that everything's changing moment by moment. But again, our intellectual understanding of impermanence is not really helping us in our life. Because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. It's driven by our instinctive habits. And our instinctive habits are telling us that things around us are quite stable, in fact, not really changing moment by moment. And that's how we relate to them. And that's why when we encounter pleasant things or unpleasant things, it's much easier to develop attachment to the pleasant ones, aversion to the unpleasant ones. If we meditate on this and we come to taste and experience impermanence directly in meditation, then that can have a flow-on effect in daily life. That experience in meditation can still affect our mind a little bit in the day. While that experience is still affecting us, now we are instinctively seeing things more as changing moment by moment. And the result of that is that you will find your attachment and aversion to pleasant and unpleasant things will dramatically decrease. So this is the first insight. The second insight, of course, is the insight into dukkha, the condition we find ourselves in. So if we can internalize this intellectual understanding, if we can come to really experience and see that our human condition is dukkha, then we are going to see directly that the source of happiness and suffering is not anywhere out there. It's in here. And that the mental afflictions are the source of our suffering and that we can start to eliminate them. So by realizing dukkha, that's going to lead to us to develop this aspiration for liberation from samsara, this what's called renunciation. So by realizing this, we can start to develop this aspiration for nirvana and enter into the Buddhist path to nirvana. And then how to progress to nirvana, of course, is we need the third insight. An insight into no self. So here in the Theravada tradition, within the Four Noble Truths, when we talk about what is the fundamental ignorance that we're suffering from, what is our mistaken view of reality that is the source of all of our mental afflictions and suffering, the answer is grasping to self. that we overinflate the sense of me and we grasp onto a solid, substantial me called self. And we can overinflate the sense of me in a number of levels. And here we'll talk about two particular ways of overinflating sense of me that we are to refute, to eliminate. And self here is a translation of the Sanskrit word Atman. We need to be careful when we see this word self in Buddhism, in the context of a discussion about the nature of reality. Self implies overinflated false sense of me. In other areas, like yesterday when we're discussing about compassion and so forth, we saw, as yesterday we talked about self and others. There, we're just meaning ourself versus others. We're not talking about Atman. So in that discussion, self just means myself, me, the person. Not referring to, in any way, how we exist. Just talking about person. But here, in a discussion about reality, the word self infers or means an overinflated false sense of me. Now, there were, of course, a number of traditions at the time of the Buddha, and some of these traditions posited the existence of self with certain qualities. So one idea of self or Atman that the Buddha refuted was this: the following is that some traditions at the time of the Buddha felt that the self or Atman must be something unchanging. And also, they described it as having the quality of being unitary, meaning a single thing with no parts.
Can you repeat again? Who said this thing?
A number of traditions at the time of the Buddha that he refuted. And another quality that these traditions said that the Atman had was that it was completely independent of everything else. The Buddha refuted such an idea of self or Atman. Because if we look at this, we can understand if the self or Atman is unchanging, it actually couldn't do anything. And if it was completely independent of everything else, it would be also independent of causes and conditions, but also it would imply that we could have a sense of self over there somewhere, that the self is completely independent of the body and the mind. But we never had a sense of self completely independent of the body and the mind. Our sense of self is always in connection with some aspect of the body and the mind. We never have a sense of self somewhere over there, completely independent of our body and mind. So from a Buddhist perspective, we never instinctively have this false sense of self. That this false sense of person is only something that we would intellectually come to this conclusion through our understanding. By thinking about how do we exist, we may come up with the idea, well, we're like this actually. So from a Buddhist perspective, this is only an intellectually acquired false sense of self. It's not something we instinctively have.
So, therefore, it doesn't really cause us a problem. But anyway, the Buddha refuted this. But there is another sense of self that we do instinctively have that does cause us a lot of problems. And that is this one. The technical word is self-sufficient substantial existence. What that means, and I've briefly touched on this already, is instinctively we do have a sense that there's a me here somewhere, and this me is something more than just the body and the mind. That there, the me here stands apart from the body and the mind. There's a third thing here, a me, that has a body and has a mind. This is what we're talking about here. Instinctively, we have a sense, again, that there is this autonomous me, a me that is definitely more than just the collection of the body and the mind here. And that's how we relate to ourselves. As I said already, we say things like, I have a body, I have a mind, as if there's a third thing, an extra thing, a me that has a body and has a mind. And that's how we relate to ourselves instinctively. And from a Theravada perspective, this is the root of samsara. This grasping onto this autonomous me or self-sufficient substantial existence. Self-sufficient, of course, means not seeming to rely on anything else to exist and very substantial and solid. So if we can come to realize there is no such autonomous me, we can eliminate all the mental afflictions, suffering, and achieve nirvana. So, in the Vipassana practice in Theravada, we are coming to realize there is no such self. And this is actually the meditation we just did at the beginning this morning, is we were looking for this self-sufficient, substantially existent me. Any questions about either of those? Sorry, the what? Oh, unitary means it's a single thing with no parts. You can't break it up into parts.
I might be getting ahead of things here, but why does the me exist then? Was it there for a survival point of view, or
why does it exist?
Why do you need the third thing to integrate the mind?
Well, there is no third thing. That's the thing. Is there is no third thing on top of the body and the mind. But because we believe there is, we have mental afflictions and suffering. So here the realization is there is no extra third thing separate from the body and the mind. But does that mean that there is no me at all? No. No Buddhist tradition says there is no me.
So why was it, if it's like a mental production, then why is it there?
It's always been there. Ignorance has always been there.
Why? Why is it?
Causes and conditions.
In Bhagavad Gita,
Hindu,
There is a concept, Atman, but that Atman is not self or ego we are talking about now. The Atman is beyond the self, true self.
So remember, very good point. So remember, when Buddhism refutes Atman, we're refuting these ideas of Atman. Atman is just a word, and different traditions can use that word to describe very different things. So, if we have an idea of Atman, to see whether or not Buddhism refutes it, we have to look what is our idea of Atman. Because again, it's just a word. Buddhism refutes this and this type of Atman. That's all.
But that means even Hinduism, they already had that idea about true self, not this self. They already had idea.
Yeah. I mean, every tradition, every tradition who has an idea of liberation from suffering comes up with their idea of true self or reality or whatever. Of course, of course.
So before you said the difference between Buddha and other spiritual teachings at that time was the realization about no self.
Correct. So the point is, a system or tradition can have an idea of true self or reality, but is it accurate and correct, is the question. And there are many theories and systems at the time of the Buddha who had an idea of true self, of ultimate reality, and what the Buddha saw was that many of these were false. For example, this one. So that's the question, is not whether a tradition has an idea of true self or ultimate reality, where it is that an accurate idea of true self or reality? That's the question.
For me, the Hindu Atman idea is very similar with Buddha's idea.
Very good. And so, as we're going to see coming, the idea of emptiness, if our idea of Atman matches that, then Atman exists. So it completely depends on our idea of what we mean by the word Atman. It's just a word. Just like soul is just a word. For example, if our idea of soul is this, then Buddhism would refute that soul. But we can equally use the word soul to talk about something completely different. So remember, this is what we are refuting here. Yeah? We're not refuting everyone's idea of the word Atman. It depends on what it refers to. So remember, self is an overinflated false sense of me. Now, and this is going to come later, but I'll give a little bit information now because I have to talk more to clearly explain it. The difficulty here is we generally identify with this as me. And for us now, there's just two possibilities. Either there is this me or there's no me. Because the only me we've related to is this. So if this doesn't exist, for us, that means there's no me. So often, when people come into the Vipassana practice and start to undermine these false sense of me, they flip to the other extreme of nihilism. Oh, if I don't exist like that, then there's no me. I don't exist. And I'm going to talk about that later. What we're saying here, and that's why the Buddhist view of reality is subtle and profound, is that there's a middle way between. There's a third possibility. There's not just if either this is me or there's no me. There's a middle way between those two. And that's what we're going to try to discover today. It's just our experience of being the witness or the observer. So in the shamatha practice, we're observing the breath, we're observing the mind. That's our experience. Here, what we're asking is how, not whether or not there's a witness or an observer. Of course there's a witness and an observer, just like there's a person. The question here is, how does the witness or observer exist? That's what we're trying to work out here. Not whether or not there's a witness or an observer. Of course there is. Again, Buddhism is not trying to determine does a cup exist or not? We're simply trying to determine how does the cup exist? How do I exist? How does the witness exist? How does the observer exist? That's what we're trying to determine here today. Yeah? Not whether or not there's a witness or an observer. Of course there is.
Can you repeat again? What's the difference between an independent self and a self-sufficient substantiated?
Yeah. This one would imply that you could have a sense of me over there somewhere. A sense of me completely separate from the body and the mind, which we never do. This
is part of the body.
No, it sort of has its own, it's autonomous, but it's inside, mixed. It's somewhere mixed in here. That's the difference.
Just a quick question about semantics. If I conceive of myself as the body, as a combination of the body and the mind, it's semantically correct to say I have a body and I have a mind.
You can't say that, that's right.
You can't.
Why not? Because you can't be something and have it. It's illogical.
It's not if you are a combination of the body and the mind. I am a combination of those two things. I am neither of them independently. I have both. And I am a combination of the two. That's absolutely correct, just from a linguistic perspective.
It's not, actually. Yeah.
I don't
see why not. Anyway, maybe it'll get answered later, because we're going to really touch on this point more directly later. And I think the reason we find this maybe difficult to accept that it's illogical. No, actually, I better not go there. It'll come. It'll just be confusion, whatever I say now. I'll try and approach it in a very methodical way this morning and this afternoon. Yeah, I don't know who was next. Who was next? Okay.
Back to the witness and observer.
Sure.
That's really confusing to me. Sure. Saying that all there is to this me is a mind stream and a body. Right?
All that's there is to the me.
That is all this me is.
No.
Okay, so
no. No, that's the same point over here. Again, the me, I am not the body and mind. See, and I'll give a short answer, but the answer is going to come, particularly after lunch, this afternoon session, is that the me is not the same as the body and the mind, and it's not different than the body and the mind. And the reason we say that is same and different is dualistic talk. Two things either are the same or they're different. But this is duality. So what we're talking about here is going beyond duality. So the short answer is that the person is not the same as the body and the mind or different than the body and the mind, because this is dualistic way of thinking. And that's why this is difficult, because people want to conceptually, dualistically find the answer. There is no dualistic answer, conceptual answer. Because the answer is, dualism is the false view. So we have to go beyond that. So here, intellectually, conceptually, we will never find the answer. Because we are locked in the problem. The problem is dualistic thinking. That's the middle way, is to go beyond that. But how to do that, we'll look at it. It's coming. So we're not here. This is, in fact, these ideas in the Theravada traditions, the problem is how we overinflate ourselves like this. But the philosophical systems that are the basis of the Theravada traditions accept duality. There is an independent objective world there, made up of atoms and subatomic particles. This is the view in these schools. The problem is not how we see the world. There is an objective world there. That's not a problem, they say. The problem is only how we see ourselves as a person. We overinflate the sense of me, believing we are existing like this. What I'm going to do now, of course, is go into the Mahayana. And in the Mahayana, the fundamental ignorance is something deeper than this. The fundamental ignorance is this grasping to duality, the grasping onto independent me, independent objective world. We haven't started that discussion yet. That's coming now. So maybe keep the question to this and not about duality, because we haven't started that yet.
After death, is it the mind that will be reincarnated in another body, or is it the self?
The self does not exist. It never has existed, it cannot exist. Is the Buddhist assertion, of course.
And when you say,
does the mind get reincarnated? It depends what you mean when you say that, so the answer could be yes or no, and I'm going to clarify that this afternoon.
So when we cannot answer, I have mind, I have body, if you have
a body
and if you have a body, then you cannot be the mind and the body?
Correct.
So that's an illusion.
That's
an illusion.
What's an illusion?
The fact that we...
No. The illusion is believing that we are the body and the mind. That's the illusion. That's not an illusion. That's accurate understanding. According to Buddhism, of course.
So we are not the self and we are not the body and the mind.
Correct. I mean, self doesn't exist from a Buddhist. This idea of self doesn't exist. But again, a lot of these things I haven't started to even touch on yet. So maybe one more question, then we need to move on, because I think a lot of these questions hopefully will be answered in our discussion this morning and this afternoon. So one more.
Can you describe shortly, if I'm in close to Nirvana, and you asked me, like this morning, to when I meditate, to see me or I, can you describe what do they see?
If he's progressed a long way on the path and then he observes me or I, what does that look like? The answer's coming this afternoon. Okay, let's move on, because I think a lot of these questions hopefully will be clarified in our discussions this morning and also this afternoon. So now we move on to the Mahayana. So the Mahayana, from the Sanskrit language, is building on the Four Noble Truths, particularly through what's called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra teachings from the Buddha. And here he taught the idea of emptiness, the fact that there's no independent me, no independent objective world, that everything's empty of being independent, or another way of saying that is there is no subject-object duality. Now, to introduce this topic, I'd like to read a little bit from Alan Wallace again from that same book that I've quoted a couple of times. I've quoted a couple of times this Tibetan Buddhism from the Ground Up, and the section in the book that is titled "What is Really There?" And he says the following: many of us believe that we directly perceive objective physical phenomena with our five physical senses, that the mental images we perceive via our senses are accurate representations of the objects we perceive. However, neurologist Antonio Damasio refutes this assumption, which is commonly called naive realism. So now he's quoting the neurologist, who says the following: when you and I look at an object outside of ourselves, we form comparable images in our respective brains. We know this well because you and I can describe the object in very similar ways, down to fine details. But that does not mean that the image we see is the copy of whatever the object outside is like. Whatever it is like in absolute terms, we do not know. Back to Alan Wallace. He says, in light of this neuroscientific view, with our five senses, we directly perceive images generated in the brain. But these are not truly representations of anything existing independently of the brain. These sensory impressions of colours, sounds, smells, and so on are no more tangible than thoughts or dreams. While we seem to experience colours and so on as they exist in the objective world, independent of our senses, this is an illusion, very much like a dream. Having determined that the reality we perceive depends on our sense faculties, what then really does exist outside our senses? When we close this book and leave the room, shutting the door behind us, what remains? It is an ancient question that has been asked since the time of the Greeks. What exists behind appearances? What really exists out there? This brings up a familiar problem. What happens when a tree falls and nobody is in the forest to watch it or hear it? Most people agree something happened. The tree trunk is on the ground, there is a big dent, things start to rot, and ants and termites live in the fallen trunk. But what happened? Western scientists have traditionally responded to this question by trying to find primary or intrinsic qualities of the falling tree that can be measured. Mass is one of those, the idea being that the tree has a quantifiable amount of stuff to it. Speed is another quality that does not seem to depend on anyone's perception. Briefly considering the history of Western scientific thinking on this point may be a useful digression that may help us better understand the nature of emptiness. Also, by examining our cultural assumptions about the nature of reality, we can better understand and penetrate those assumptions, and by so doing, come to appreciate the Buddhist view. Since Galileo took his telescope and turned it on Jupiter, scientific thought has increasingly depended on the power of mechanical instruments. We get the sense, and it is widely promoted by science, that by using mechanical instruments and mathematics, we stop being subjective and instead become objective. Everyone knows the senses can be misleading, it is said, so let us dispense with the senses. They are giving us only appearances anyway, and we are trying to penetrate through those. The idea of objective measurement came to be strongly emphasized during the time of Galileo, and by the end of the 19th century, scientists felt the objective science of physics was virtually complete. The physics of the time was assumed, with very few exceptions, to be an absolute representation of what was really out there. At the beginning of the 20th century, this view began to break down. Scientists started to understand more clearly that their instruments of measurement were themselves contributing to the data they were detecting. But the real revolution came with the development of quantum physics, which investigates the very smallest components of physical reality. It is here that the participatory nature of measurement and experimentation becomes most obvious. In quantum mechanics, attributes of mass, speed, shape, and location vanish as purely objective entities. All of them can only be seen in relationship to the methods of measurement. As the renowned physicist Werner Heisenberg said, what we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning. As scientists looked still deeper, they also started questioning the objectivity of the analytical tools they use. Mathematics, for instance, is one more human creation. Euclidean geometry is only one of a theoretically infinite number of geometries that can be used. And the same goes for algebra and for various logic systems. The subjective element seems to be inescapable on all fronts. In no facet of science, whether we are dealing with astronomy, physics, or medicine, do we even get one bit of information about any reality existing independently of our modes of questioning. All our sensory experience consists of experiences that are contingent upon our sense faculties. Even by reducing everything to the subatomic level of electrons, quarks, and so forth, we are still left with nothing but appearances. What is inescapable is that all we know of the world, theoretically and empirically, consists of appearances to the mind. We have access to nothing else. Understanding this, the concept of reification becomes universally applicable. In the same way that we look out on the world and view perceived objects as if they existed inherently in objective space, so too do we view things like electrons and sound waves as if they existed independently of our conceptions of them. Perceived objects exist in relation to the conceptual schemata within which they are understood. We reify an object by removing it from its context, by ignoring the subjective influences of perception and conception. So let's see what all that means. Again, first, let's start with a little bit of terminology. So remember here, again, we are looking at the view of reality according to the Mahayana traditions that come from the Sanskrit, and particularly here coming from these Perfection of Wisdom Sutra teachings from the Buddha, where he said that there is no independent me, no independent objective world. Nothing exists independently. So here, of course, we're talking about independent existence. And to describe this in the text, there are a number of different terms used. Probably the most common term you'll see is what's called inherent existence. And the word inherent existence has the idea of things being self-existent. Things having their own unique nature. The idea that things are made up of many separate, discrete things. Everyone, everything being self-existent, existing with its own unique nature. Another term that is commonly used is terms used as another word for independent existence, and each one is looking at that word from a slightly different perspective. So they all mean the same thing.
But can you repeat what is inherent?
Inherent means within itself. So inherent existence means things exist, are self-existent within themselves. They exist as separate, discrete things, self-existent. Another term is existing from its own side. And this term has the idea that things do not need an observer to exist. They simply exist from their own side. Meaning the world is already existing there, waiting for us to experience it. That this bowl, for example, is already sitting here existing when we walk in the door. It's already existing from its own side. It does not need an observer to exist. This is what this means. And another term you'll often see is true existence. The word true generally means If something does not deceive us, it is true. Here, of course, things appear to exist independent of us. If they actually exist in that way, they would be true. They wouldn't be deceiving us. Meaning the way in which they appear and the way in which they actually exist matches. So that's what true existence means. True existence means existing in the same way in which it appears. And there are a number of other terms sometimes you'll see, but these are probably the three most common terms that are used to describe independent existence. So again, they all mean the same thing, and they're talking about independent existence from a slightly different perspective. So that's a little bit of terminology. Yeah.
Apart. You said that, existing from some side, you define it as needing an observer in order to exist. Meaning if there's no observer, there's no existence?
Correct.
Of the thing or of anything?
What thing?
I understand that you could...
See, that's the idea of the tree in the forest. Yeah? He talked about the tree in the forest. So if there's no one in the forest, does the tree exist? That's your question?
Yeah.
What tree?
The
thing is...
I think the tree doesn't exist. But does something exist?
See, the thing is, when we're asking these questions, we're assuming. And part of the asking the question is, there's a me here who wants to know that. So if your assumption is that there's an independent me here who wants to know if there's a tree in the forest if no one's observing it, the answer is, of course there is a tree, because you're assuming independent me, therefore there must be independent world. So to really get a good answer for these sorts of questions, if there's nobody in the forest, does the tree exist? What we really need to start asking is, who's the me who wants to know that? Because very often when people ask these sorts of questions, without really realizing it, they're holding on to the idea of independent me. And if there's an independent me, then of course there is an independent tree in the forest, even if there's no one there to watch it or hear it. Of course. By default. So this is the interesting point to your question, is who's the me who wants to know this? If you get the answer to that, you get the answer to your question. And we're going to talk about particularly the me this afternoon. Who's the me who wants to know if there's a tree in the forest existing if no one is there to watch it? That's what we're going to try to answer this afternoon.
The point is that we cannot give an answer to that question because we cannot see the tree, so we don't know if there is a tree or there isn't a tree.
See, the problem is...
We admit the idea that there is an independent me, or we think that everything is interdependent, but we don't have information to choose between the two. And it is, we have to keep the tension between the two, because yeah. We cannot...
Again, another way of answering this, which I just mentioned already, is... You can never get a proper intellectual answer to this question because the problem is duality. So you cannot get a correct conceptual answer because conceptuality is the problem. So there is an answer, but the answer can only come through direct experience, the direct answer, the correct answer.
And if we don't want to be wrong intellectually, we just have to keep the tension.
No. No. We can, and we need to, develop an intellectual framework for this practice. If we develop an intellectual framework for this practice, it's a bit like in that diagram of the wheel of life. You know, and we talked about nirvana. Is also, according to Mahayana, nirvana is a state of complete non-duality. So can you describe nirvana then? No. So what is the Buddha doing? He's pointing, isn't he? To the moon, to nirvana. And then under there we have the description. So pointing means giving some framework to point us in the right direction. So that we, through our own experience, can come to the direct answer ourselves. We will never get the direct answer to this question in conceptually. And when we do get the answer to this question through direct experience, then someone comes to us and says, tell me the answer. We'll go, sort of like this. Because the problem is, if this person hasn't had that experience, whatever you say, which is conceptual and dualistic, is leading, potentially leading them astray. All we can do to help people, if we've had that experience, is use language to sort of point them in the right direction. And then it's up to them whether they move in that direction to come to experience the answer themselves or not. That's all we can do.
But you said before in one of the first presentations that the way is to listen and then concentrate.
Correct. And then meditate.
Because the minute I listen and meditate, I put into motion this cognitive trap that I think in a dualistic way. I cannot think in another way.
We need to use our conceptual mind to go beyond conception. We need a framework to help us, as the Buddha pointed. The pointing is the framework. If we have no framework of intellectual understanding, we sit down to meditate, what are we going to do? We're just going to blank our mind? We've got nothing to do. We don't know what to do. And if we have some sort of experience, what does that mean? Is it an experience of reality? Or am I just spacing out? Or what's going on? No idea. We need that framework. But the nice analogy I like to use here is the map is not the territory. But if we want to navigate the territory, we need a map. If we don't have a map, we just get lost, don't we?
So the dualism is the same stuff.
Yes, so the conception, duality, the conception is the map. But if we want to discover something, looking at the map, we'll never discover anything. We have to go and look in the territory. So we use the map to navigate, and then in the territory we discover something. But then, of course, we leave the map behind. We don't need the map anymore if we see directly. So this is what we're talking about. We need the map to navigate the territory. Okay, it's time for a morning tea break. So after the tea break, we're going to look at the idea here that nothing exists independently, and of course we're not saying therefore nothing exists, the implication then is everything exists dependently. And so what we're going to do after the break is, what does it mean for things to exist dependently? So we'll look at that after the break.